we all tend to grow up thinking about our primary residence where it's based upon comps. I can have the nicest house in the worst neighborhood and that pulls me down. It pulls everybody else up and vice versa. As we know, in the multifamily world, it's a business. And so it's evaluated based upon the cash that it's generating, which is referred to as the net operating income.
If you have over $200,000 sitting stagnant in your bank, retirement account, or home equity, then you're literally losing money. On this show, you learn how to get that money working for you consistently and conservatively. Learn to grow your nest egg with your host, Sean Winslow. Let's dive in.
Welcome back to another Multifamily Monday episode. I'm your host, Sean Winslow, and this is the Multifamily Money Podcast. What is going on, everyone? You know the drill. Every Monday, I'm coming at you with a real estate-specific multifamily episode. And today, we've got a guest. But before I get into that, a little housekeeping as always, and that's the fee. And you guys know the fee. Any value out of this, please, please share with someone who you think could also get value. Be a friend, family, colleague, just an acquaintance that maybe you're randomly talking real estate with. Would love you for you to share it. Don't make any money off this. The only way to get in front of more people, because that's what we're here to do, to share what I've learned and what my guests have learned, you, the listener, so we give back to this wonderful community. So the only way to do that is for you to refer this to others. And then if you haven't done so, please leave a rating review on Apple Podcasts. That's another way that Apple algorithm gets it in front of more ears. And I mentioned this before that I was on a journey. They hit 100 ratings and reviews on Apple by the end of, I think it was June. We hit it beginning mid-May. And then something happened where a bunch got deleted. We went all the way back down to, I think, like 70, 71. But now we're back up to 96. We're almost there. So if you haven't left one, please get on, do that. Let's try to get to 100 by the end of this month. All right, but let's get into what the episode is today. And our guest, Randy Langendurfer, is out of Houston, Texas. He currently still has a W-2 job, works for one of the healthcare systems there, finance guy. And he also has his own real estate investment firm on the side. And he started off, like a lot of people in real estate, on the single family side. He was fixing and flipping, hard money lender, all that stuff. And then he realized that's a hamster wheel, right? You're constantly spinning, a lot of moving parts, and it's a lot of work to scale. And he was introduced to multifamily and he just saw it as the better way to truly build wealth and passive income. So now he is not only an investor actively, but also passively. And he's a coach on the Rod Kleef's coaching program. We've had Rod on the show before. As I said, he is the godfather of multifamily podcasting. And yeah, so this was a really fun conversation. Randy and I got into a lot of different things. Talked about, you've heard me say this before, that going forward, a deal is really going to become a good deal through operations. That's going to be a big part of it. An unprecedented appreciation over the last several years, but now it's really going to come into operations. So we talk a lot about operations and just kind of the nuances of being an active versus passive investor. This is a fun show. I think you're all going to enjoy it. So without further ado, here is Randy. Hey, Randy, welcome to the show.
Good morning, Sean. It's a pleasure to be here. Thanks for the opportunity.
Thank you for coming on. I know you're a busy guy, so I appreciate that. And let's just get into it. Everyone loves a good origin story. So who is Randy? What do you do? What led you there?
Sure. So Randy Langendurfer, Houston, Texas, where I reside today. My wife always scolds me when I get in these that I don't talk about my family enough. So I should start that I'm a father. I'm a husband of four kids, three of them adult, all four of them are adult actually. But so father, husband, I'm still actively employed in the medical center in Houston, Texas, and have been for a while. And on my passion or my side hustle is real estate. So I got involved in real estate, Sean, back in the early 2010-ish, 9-ish, doing single family flips. I was a hard money lender with a brother-in-law with a group out of South Florida, Dade County. And I was living in Cleveland, Ohio at the time and relocated to Houston for business purposes and got into multifamily and educated. And so fast forward to today, I'm a general partner in about 1,100 doors and a passive investor in about 4,000 doors over the time period.
That's impressive. And what made you change? Because you start off with that, the fix and flip kind of single family. What made you change to multifamily? Because I see this transition a lot, but what was your reasoning behind that?
So I had a brother-in-law who I really know, like, and respect, got me into the flipping business. And I initially thought he was crazy. And he also got me involved using a self-directed IRA, which was violating a financial principle. I'm a finance guy at heart with an MBA and a CPA. And the short answer is it just became a whole lot of work. Every deal You had to find, look at the comps in the area. You had to really study the repair budget and have confidence with the group and have that relationship and get any velocity or any scale. It's a lot of work. And not that multifamily isn't work, but it's a different kind of work. And it's all kind of front loaded. And as you know, and once you get it, once you acquire it, it becomes much less time consuming. The time is all in the front loaded, I'll say, on multifamily.
Yeah. I've kind of heard that from others too, that it's kind of like when it comes to the fix and flip, you're kind of on like a hamster wheel that never stops. And I feel like that's what a lot of people have told me, that they wanted to get out of it and take more. Not that being an active multifamily investor is passive, but it's more passive than what on the fix and flip side. Like you said, it's a lot of front loaded. You put your systems and processes in place that manage throughout the hold. I guess a question that I feel like a lot of listeners would ask that want to get into, whether it's just from a passive or active side, is like, how do you manage? You got a full-time job and then you've got your own essentially investment
side business. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, my father told me a long time ago, find something you love to do and you never have to work a day in your life. And in my case, I probably put in a lot of hours, nights, weekends doing real estate, but I enjoy it. So it's really not work for me. I don't know when, but there'll come a time when I'll step aside from the corporate world and do this full time, but I just enjoy it. So it's really not work. And I'm a financial guy, as I said, so I enjoy the analytical side of it, the business, the spreadsheet analysis, the underwriting. I enjoy the property management side of the business as well, because that's where the deal is really made or broken. It's property management. You know, we have multi-million dollar assets that somebody making $40,000, $50,000 a year is really running it day to day, and it takes oversight. So I think it's just a passion. And if you enjoy what you do, I mean, whether some people golf, some people vacations, build houses, mine is just commercial real estate.
There's a couple of things I want to ask you off that, because you said a lot of good things right there. First, okay. So you're a finance guy, because for those that aren't familiar, when it comes to the big multifamily world, this is a team sport. You're not really finding one person out there doing everything. So you said you're a finance guy, you love numbers, analytical side of stuff. Is that kind of your role? Underwriting, analysis, and then managing?
Fair question. I've taken multiple roles in different deals. I guess that's my first love, I'll call it, is the analytical side of it, the underwriting side of it, the analysis, the deal chasing. So yeah, both as a passive investor and most importantly, as a general partner, I scrutinize the underwriting very cautiously. Sean, I always say my favorite tagline is, I've never heard a syndicator say, I underwrite very aggressively.
Yeah.
We all say I underwrite.
Level of conservatism.
Yeah. It's the level of conservative, as you said. So one man's conservative is another man's or woman's aggressiveness. It's just kind of peculiar to me to start looking into it. And I think investors need to really do that more and educate themselves. So my day job is really what I would say I'm educated in the finance world. I do have an MBA in finance and a CPA, but my day job is really around corporate risk areas. So identifying risk and trying to develop mitigation strategies as a chief compliance and audit officer in cybersecurity. So you're really thinking about that, transition that to the multifamily world. It's what's the best way to mitigate your risk? Because as you said, one of the limited beliefs is I don't have the knowledge. Well, the way to conquer that limited belief, I don't have the knowledge or I don't know the people, is educate yourself. And as you said, there are so many ways today to educate yourself that weren't available when I got started. I mean, there's tons of YouTubes, there's meetups, there's large educational groups across the country. And I'm just kind of always amazed that people starting out really don't want to spend any money to educate themselves. We all spent a lot of money either getting a bachelor's degree or a vocational degree or an advanced degree. Many are inhibited to spend money on their real estate education. And so you get what you pay for. And I'm a coach in Rod Khalif's organization today. And so I really enjoy that. But it's something that there's just a ton of information out there, but it does require you to have a desire to learn that.
Right.
And I'm sure you've got investors. I've got investors that are just on autopilot. They say, I know Sean, I like him. Here's X amount of dollars for a deal. And then there's the other person that's going to spend an hour on the phone asking you all the intimate questions. And they're both valid. But I enjoy talking to the one that really wants to know more and ask questions.
Yeah. And to go off of that person and your underwriting and finance background, what is something you've seen that limited partners say they want to invest with you, Randy, or another operator out there? What is something they should look out for in what we would call aggressive underwriting? Because I've seen some pretty wild assumptions, especially in the last year or two.
Yeah, that's key. You hit it, Sean. I mean, the common questions I ask and encourage people to think about is, what's the big picture or the assumptions? And those are, in any spreadsheet, there are a ton of different models out there, but the assumptions are, what are your rent growth assumptions, your expense growth assumptions? What's the buying cap and reversion cap rate estimations when you're selling? Huge implication on the returns, as you know. Look at, what's the property management? Again, that's a line item or a cell on a spreadsheet, property management. But what's their experience? I mean, ask the sponsor, what relationship do you have with this property, third-party property management, or maybe you're doing it yourself? What's their experience in this submarket? What's their experience with this type of asset? I mean, you find a lot of people that had a relationship with somebody and they bought a Class A, but they've been doing Class C for the last 10 years. That's a different risk factor. And then, I mean, the other ones you got to drill into is the debt. So are they... And the assumptions underwriting, are we talking bridge debt's very popular today? That's okay, but just know what you're getting into versus longer term debt with one of the agencies. And so again, ton of YouTubes out there, videos, people can begin to get their head around if they want to.
Yeah. And I think it goes back to what you were saying earlier. It all comes down to education. Even if you don't want to do it actively, even if you just want to be a limited partner, you still need to educate yourself. So when you're looking at a deal, you know what to look for.
Yeah. I don't think there's really anything such thing as a truly passive investor.
Right.
Investment, I should say, passive investment. Because if you're truly just throwing money at Sean or Randy or somebody else, to me, that's speculation versus investor who understands the deal and understands the risk parameters and gets comfortable with them. Take Warren Buffett. He says, it's not the exact phrase, but I think he says, diversification is for losers. It's not a quote, but it's the strategy there. But when he understands an industry, he goes all in.
Right.
He puts massive money in specific industries and companies when he understands them. He educates himself. That's how he mitigates the risk. So
it's true. No one gets extremely wealthy by spreading out their entire investment over different asset classes, different industries within those asset classes, different sectors within those asset classes. It just doesn't happen. Yeah, it's a good defensive strategy once you've built the wealth, but that's not how you're going to build it.
And you get the finance world, the traditional finance world is going to sell you on an index fund, right? And put your money in an index fund where you get the market, because that's diversification. You get the market. That's just it. You get the market. So
yeah,
when the market's up, you're going to do good. But when the market goes down like it has recently, you're going to tank versus hard assets such as real estate. Has anybody ever seen it? Well, I guess it could happen, but I've never seen a multifamily go to zero.
Yeah. Even if it burns to the ground, you're going to get some insurance money. So
yeah.
And you got the land too. So it's not going to go to zero. It's funny you say that, because I just had a conversation. Someone was trying to refer me to their financial advisor in the sense that we could have some type of referral relationship, because I'm obviously not a financial planner. They obviously don't, do real estate other than REITs, which if you ask for real estate and your financial advisor gives you a REIT, I would probably get a new financial advisor. But I will also say I am not a financial planner, so don't take my advice. I used to be licensed, though. I will say that. But my point is, the individual said they didn't want to be introduced to me because they would never recommend real estate in a balanced portfolio. And now, Randy, you and I could take this discussion on many different angles right now. From that quote to tear it apart. But my point was, to your point, is the whole index thing. I don't know if it was a coincidence or my RAS working, but that same day I saw a tweet that showed a chart of correlations between stocks and bonds. And it's the highest it's been in decades at 0.64. And anyone who knows correlation, when you're at one, that means things move in tandem. And the closer you get, obviously, 0.64 is high, especially for something that's traditionally been in that balanced portfolio where you do a 60-40 split, generally 70-30, depending on your age, 60% stocks, 40% bonds. So it's just funny how it just made me chuckle, because that's not a balanced portfolio.
I got to chime in on that one, because you hit a point with me. So I have a couple of high net worth individuals, one specifically a friend for a long time and very high net worth. And he has probably 80% of his portfolio in bonds because he's made his wealth and he doesn't need it. And I have another friend who's got a double digit net worth, an 8-figure net worth, and he's got it all in cash. And I try to explain to them. So the institution of which I work at today has a $2 billion endowment of which invested in. So I'm invited to the investment committees and see all their reports and stuff. And I've talked to our chief investment officer. And it's interesting that over the last several, I don't know if it's several years or whatever, how you have your portfolio allocation of bonds and assets and domestic and foreign and et cetera, but how it used to be real estate was lumped into the alternative asset line of the portfolio mix, because they always have 5% or 6% of the asset of the allocation dedicated to alternative investments. And that could mean crypto to real estate. Well, fast forward to today, and last in 2019, they started calling out a $2 billion portfolio real estate as a single line item, which surprised me, because I think the traditional money managers think, like you said, that real estate is considered an alternative asset versus a line item on your portfolio. And so then the next question I asked our chief investment officer was, okay, so how much of the portfolio do we have allocated to real estate? And he said anywhere's, their minimum was 8% to 15% of $2
billion. $2 billion. Yeah.
Now they're not buying, well, they're not buying the kind of assets we buy. They're buying more institutional funds. And they're, I don't know if I couldn't get, if that was broken down between industrial or office or just what the asset classifications were, but still, smart money is moving towards identifying a portion of your portfolio in real estate. So I go back to my high net worth friend and I ask him, I said, ask your advisor, what's he say about real estate as a line item? And surprisingly enough, he said he's working with somebody who's pretty pretty smart and pretty proactive. And he said, yeah, you should have some in real estate. And this is beyond your primary principal residence. And so I felt a little bit of a win there to make the argument, but each conversation is unique, because you're right. The traditional market sees it as bonds and markets, and I mean, bonds and stocks, equities.
Oh, yeah. And I think it's going to become more and more prevalent to see it more as a Main Street investment class.
I was telling them, my high net worth friend, I said, when you go to a surgeon, what do you think they're going to recommend? Surgery. When you go to a physical therapist, what do you think they're going to recommend? Physical therapy. They're not going to recommend surgery and vice versa. That's one small example. And so it is with a traditional financial advisor. They know stocks and bonds, and that's what they're trained to sell. And that's where they get compensated. They don't get compensated for encouraging you to put money in a private placement memorandum.
Exactly. And people got to think that. That's why the stock and bond market are so huge, because you know, it's where the money is. And so these huge firms have the marketing dollars to condition us to think this is the way to invest. Put in a 401k, put an IRA, mutual funds, index funds. That's the way to do. And to one point, it's better than doing nothing. But if you're going to invest, there are other ways. And I guess this leads to this question. You're a finance guy. Why real estate, and why specifically multifamily do you like as an investment vehicle?
Well, I was just sharing this with somebody, back to my financial advisor. I still have one. And, you know, I used to, I don't know if you ever heard of the Aristocrats fund, the Aristocrat stocks. So those are stocks and bonds that had been paying a dividend for the last 20, 25 years. And so back to what I was trying to create when I was much more into the market was that cash flow that we're talking about that we get in real estate. So the Aristocrats were those stocks that had been paying a cash dividend for 25 plus years, plus growth, whatever. So those are hard to find in today's market. Those are very hard to find.
Yeah.
Somebody that has a long-term track record, even like General Electric had been paying dividends for 35 plus years and their company changed overnight. And there are a lot of investors that were, I'm assuming, lost a lot of money. So why commercial real estate first, and then why multifamily? Why commercial real estate is just simply, I can't find an asset in the stock market that has one tax advantage, that has positive cash flow, and has forced appreciation. So those three things of positive tax advantage, I should say favorable tax treatment, positive cash flow. I get a payment on my multifamilies. It's coming in. It's a kicker. And there's forced appreciation. And when I got my head around forced appreciation, we all tend to grow up thinking about our primary residence where it's based upon comps. I can have the nicest house in the worst neighborhood and that pulls me down. It pulls everybody else up and vice versa. But as we know, in the multifamily world, it's a business. And so it's evaluated based upon the cash that it's generating, which is referred to as the net operating income. So if I can raise net operating income, either by increasing revenue or decreasing expenses, I'm adding value and creating value, forced appreciation into the asset. So short answer, I haven't found something in the stock market that gives me that favorable tax treatment, positive cash flow, and forced appreciation.
Yeah. And
the other one I just heard the other day, I really like too. So if I want to go out and buy 1,000 shares, or let's just say 100 shares of Apple, because it's a hot stock and I really love it, it's a great stock, I got to have 100% of the cash to buy that. I got to have 100% of the cash. So in multifamily and commercial real estate, I don't have to have the cash. It's a leverage. I got to have 25% of it, maybe 40% of it as a down payment as equity, but I can leverage the rest of it. And so I'm sorry, I'm getting wound up here because I love it.
That's exactly what I was going to say. I was going to say the kicker is you get to use a smart and generally safe form of leverage to buy more than maybe the cash you have. So yeah, I love that aspect too. I use that example too. It's like, if you want to go buy stocks, you need 100% of the cash. Like, yeah, there are margin accounts, but I would never recommend margin accounts to anyone. So you need 100% of cash, whereas multifamily or commercial real estate, you don't.
And I've never seen, well, I guess it's happened, but I've just never been involved in a hard asset such as real estate going to zero.
Right.
The value may have dropped, but it's going to come back quicker than the stock market does as time. So
there's different exit strategies too, right?
I once owned a condominium in Myrtle Beach that I bought in 2006 and 2009 when the market crashed, it lost half its value. I just held it for another 10 years. Cash flowed it. Got a check every month.
That's a good point too. A lot of the push for real estate, like cash flowing real estate lately, has been, you know, the lifestyle thing, the FIRE, financial independence, retire early, live on the cash flow, which, yeah, that's great and all, and that can happen. But for me, the real kicker of cash flow is being able to weather the type of storm you just referenced. That's what, to me, the cash flow is there for. So you can hold on to the asset even in the bad times and come out of it and capture the appreciation. Because if it didn't cash flow, you may have been forced to sell that. Maybe not, but like some people in that circumstance definitely would have to sell in that circumstance.
Yeah, I guess I'm fortunate I didn't have to sell it.
Yeah.
But yeah, I was able to hold it and just continue to cash flow it. And the rents dropped and the rents came back over a period of several years. And oh, by the way, you know, we got to vacation there once in a while. So it wasn't a bad deal.
That's a great deal. I've been thinking about that too. I'm a long-term investor, but in the short-term rental standpoint, I would do it so I could have a place to go maybe a week, a year. I think that's a pretty cool strategy.
Regrettably, I never got there as often as I wanted to, but that's my personal problem.
That's usually how it happens though. We're busy. So talk about being busy. Like, what does a day look like for you, Randy? You're obviously a busy guy, full-time job, but let's talk more about the real estate side of things. 1,100 units active and what, several thousand more passive? Yeah.
So I got four deals right now that I'm a GP in. So I'm asset management call. There's 4 hours every week where I'm joining the asset management call, where we as the general partners are talking to the third-party property management and understanding where the key performance indicators are, what's the rent increases. You give them your business plan when you buy the place, and then you work with them to implement it. So increasing rents, making improvements to the property, understanding the where the CapEx is being spent, how many vacancies we got, what are we increasing on, rents on to what level, all those kinds of details. That's why people passive invest, because they don't want to sit in those kinds of calls, and they don't want to be involved with those minutia details. They want their check or their report once a month. So we give them, as I'm sure you do, you give them, your investors, a monthly report and the status. And then we try to shell out our distributions at least quarterly. And that's why the difference between active and passive investing. So I spend my day in the office, and then I get out as early as I can, and I come home and I do it all again, trying to look at more deals, trying to find more deals and trying to build relationships with investors. So who's Randy Langendorfer, and why would you want to spend your hard-earned money with me or Sean or anybody else? And so that's back to, there's nothing such thing as passive. People gain comfort with those they, as you know, like, and trust. If somebody knows me, likes me, and trusts me, I'm halfway home in terms of getting them to invest in something. So spend a lot of time on calls like this throughout whenever I touch base with somebody, and it's weekends are the same. I try to dedicate a good portion of time to my family and my wife. But the rest of the time is I'm sitting here at my desk, my home office, doing this stuff.
Love it. And to your point of that type of passive investor that's not necessarily passive, it's a great point. When I'm thinking of my favorite investors, and by favorite, I mean ones that are engaged, invest repeatedly, and also are not, you know, I guess, I don't know what the term I want to use, but know, like, and trust me. Those are the ones that put up a lot of work, that were a lot of work in the beginning, right? They wanted to know every single detail. They wanted to talk to several different references of past investors and current investors. And it was a true courtship. And yeah, it's a lot of work for both parties, myself and investor. But to your point, once they get to that point where they know, like, and trust you, it's the easiest and most fulfilling relationship from a investor standpoint there is, because they know what you do, they know what to expect, and they're just going to continue to invest.
Yeah. I mean, one of the best conversations you have, I'm sure you can relate, is we're getting ready to sell one of the four assets, and it's going to be a very handsome, it's going to be a home run. That's what it's going to be. I'm looking forward to some of those conversations, because you're right. And those investors will come back in droves the next opportunity if they have cash. That's the only obstacle. And in my own life, when I said I'm a passive investor, I think that makes me a better general or an active investor. But I remember the first couple of times I did this, I mean, I drove to Dallas and all around Texas looking at these assets and just had an hour conversation with these guys. And I would call them when we get the monthly or quarterly reports and ask a few questions. I wasn't trying to be invasive, but I was trying to learn. And now, if that same person sends me a deal, if I've got cash and I can afford it, I don't even talk to them. I just send it.
Boom. Yeah. That's the place anyone wants to be in, right?
Where do I wire?
It makes it easier for everyone. Rinse and repeat. But it takes time to get to that point, obviously. And I'm a little hesitant when you get someone right out of the gate that wants to send it that easily. It's like, no, let's both do our due diligence here and make sure it's a good fit for both parties.
Well, and that's because you're different than a lot of people. There's a lot of syndicators out there. So thank you. Here's where you wire your money.
Yeah, right. It can make life tough for everyone if you're not doing the work up front.
Well, and that's our job. That's our job to kind of help educate the investor that nothing is risk-free.
Right.
We believe this is a very lower risk or a risk mitigated investment, but nothing is risk-free. I had an investor who recently, a woman I've known for, a long time, found me on LinkedIn and re-engaged in our old relationship. Well, the short story is she was a missionary working abroad, came back to the U.S. and had just inherited some money, and she wanted to invest in my property. I'm going, please really know this is a long-term investment. It's illiquid. This is really something that I want to pause and have you think about. Do you really want to do this? Because it is a long, and this woman didn't have a whole lot of money. I know she didn't, because she was a missionary. And fantastic story. She ended up investing after a couple conversations, and it's back to the know, like, and trust. And that's an awesome and a burdensome responsibility on us as syndicators with somebody else's money like that. At least I take it that serious.
100%. We're a steward of their money. They worked hard for it. And to that point, I don't want someone that's their last 50,000. I'm hesitant with that too. I know some others aren't, but like you said, it's a long-term investment that's generally liquid. So.
And if you've been doing this long enough, you've got some horror stories in your repertoire. Came out of it okay, probably, but there were some bumps and some bruises. And the other one is I want to be able to sit across the Thanksgiving or Christmas table from friends and family and not have them look at me as like I'm a schmuck. So
it's or be able to sleep at night, too. Yeah. That's an important one.
Somebody's going
to
knock at my door.
That's how I always think of it. Yeah. But to your part that, yeah, there is bumps in the road. And you mentioned earlier about entrusting someone who's getting paid $50,000 a year to manage your property. Recently, we had to, and this goes also to your point of like, do you want to be active or passive? Because it's kind of the stuff you have to do. We had to let one of our property managers go. It just, they took their foot off the gas. There was no accountability there.
Right.
This was during a heavy turn. We had $2.2 million in CapEx that, we're repositioning 75% of the property. So we needed someone there that had accountability. Those are the things you have to do. And it goes to the point you're talking about being on these asset management calls, flying to the property or going to the property, depending on how close you are to it. And that's what you have to do as active general partner is you have to take ownership as well. And I don't know if you have any stories like that that you want to talk about.
Oh, I can talk another whole podcast on that. But I mean, it's all that. And as an active partner, you're developing communications, monthly reports. It's the accounting and the record keeping on the back end that the passive investor really doesn't see. All they know is where's my money and when do I get my K-1? And I'm that way myself too. But there's just a tremendous amount of work that goes into the back end of it and all those and why passive investors should really get to know the active people like Sean and Randy or other whoever else you're investing in so that you can get. One of my favorite stories we had real quickly, I'll try to summarize 6 years in about 30 seconds, which my first investment I ever did as a passive investor was in a community, a 250 unit property with a sponsor that I know, liked, and trust. Put my first $50,000 in, and it was subsequently had fraud by the property manager. Then we had a flood It took out all the first floor units. And then we had a fire, which two people died in the property.
Oh.
And then fast forward, the pandemic hit. And so bad things can happen. The good news is we were able to get out of it, didn't lose any money. But it was tribute to that general partner who was running the deal. One, he put an immense amount of his own time in it. He communicated with investors, and he was just thoroughly committed to making the limited partners hold when it did sell. He had pumped his own money into it, and he could have taken his own payment back by the operating agreement first before paying the limited partners. But instead, he paid all the limited partners all their money and basically took the loss, any losses himself, which that guy sends me a deal, I'm investing.
100%. And that's what people have to think about too, right?
Right.
From both sides. That's how I want to operate. And one, it's the right thing to do, but also this is a business. You know, Randy and I are creating businesses, and businesses are based off of, in my opinion, integrity. And that individual has a lot of integrity. So people like yourself, Randy, and others are going to keep coming back to him. And I think that's what a lot of operators have to think about. Don't think about the money you could make now. Think about the future. And also think about, like to our point earlier, we're stewards of other people's hard work and money. And that's what we're there for.
And I think especially in this market, Sean, it's about operations that I think is going to differentiate deals today. You could have been in the market for the last 6 years just doing deals kind of fat, dumb, and happy.
Yeah.
But these days, I think it's going to take much more active management on the operations side to make deals plan or make implement the business plan. And so asset managers, active partners specifically, acting in the asset management role, you really need to, as a passive investor, you really need to get your head around what that general partner's experience is as an asset manager and
yeah.
who they use as the property management company, they said before, and what's the property management's experience?
Yeah, that experience also, to your point earlier, comes not just, it could be a property management company that's been around for 30 plus years, but maybe they've never been in the market that you're going into. That could make or break that investment, right? Just because they've killed it maybe in Houston, Texas, where Randy is, doesn't mean they're going to kill it in Atlanta, Georgia, where they've never been. You know, it's a completely different market. And that's a big thing about real estate that people have to realize is so market specific. That's another thing to look out for.
We just had a big property management company here in Houston, big name that I won't mention, but just recently filed for bankruptcy. I don't know how that happens other than somebody just really took their eye off the ball and lost it. And they were the property managers in one of the assets that I'm passively invested in. And thank goodness the partners, the active partners in this deal, were aware of their pending demise and got rid of them early. And this was a well-recognized firm that I know many people have used, and 9 months, a year ago, would have had a 5-star rating.
Wow. Well, I'll have to pick your brain to see who that is offline, because we use a company out of Houston. But I think I would have heard about that by now if that was the case.
Yeah, you would have. You're safe. But this goes back to that operations aspect. We as investors always tend to look at the upside and the 20% IRR or the 15% cash on cash or whatever it is, or 4-point equity multipliers, whatever statistics you're looking at. But what's their success record or what's their track record in operations? And those deals are created by good property management. But I just think the market has changed in the last 9 months, a year through COVID, that I think operations is going to distinguish good deals from average deals.
I couldn't agree more. I actually tweeted about that a couple of weeks ago, kind of word for word, that the unprecedented growth in real estate appreciation has made everyone look like a hero, right? And going forward, it's going to come down to operations for sure, because we're not going to see this type of appreciation maybe in the short term right now, but definitely not in the long term, or at least the next 12 to 24 months. Inflation, that's a whole different story. We're seeing expense growth, supply chain issues, labor shortage. It's hard to hire people. Yeah, it's going to really come down to keep really looking at that spreadsheet that income statement and really managing those expenses. Yeah, that's what's going to come down to.
I mean, rising tides lifts all ships, right? And the market has been rising for the last many years. And so it's been a great time to be in the market. I don't think it's going to go out the low tide or the bottom drop out, but you're right. Manage those expenses line by line. And because of my anal nature, I'm online with the property manager. We have a monthly property call on the preliminary financials. And why is this line item up $500 or $600 or $1,000, whatever it is? And I probably drive them crazy, but it's all right. I want to
understand. You got to do it though, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
And like, you really have to stay on top of them. And property management companies, not that they're doing any, well, some of them might be doing some, you know, nefarious stuff, but probably most are trying not to, but they will hit you with fees left and right. And you really need to stay on top of them and make sure they're being above board and running it properly, because before you know it, your expenses are going to go way up.
We know there's, I don't know if we're going on a rabbit hole here, but maybe the reality is you got an on-site property manager, but then what's the back house operations that support them? The regional manager and the one person there that can't, or two people that can't do everything. You usually have a two people per 100 doors, a leasing manager, or maybe a maintenance person in there too. But anyhow, the point of it is what's the overhead, the back house accounting support, and then the training manuals and support that the on-site person gets from the regional manager is really key.
It really is. And how often are they actually going on the regional going on property? That's important too, especially at the beginning when you first take over a property, and especially if it's a big CapEx plan budget, definitely important for them to be out there and you as well. All right, Randy, well, I don't want to take too much of your time, but before I ask you the final question, where can everybody find you? I know you're a coach and you're an active investor. Where can they find you?
Sean, thanks again. It's really been a pleasure to be on your show. I've enjoyed the conversation. People can get a hold of me. Easiest way is we'll put in the show notes, but I have a webpage, invest-arc.com. There's a contact page there on that. I'm on social media on LinkedIn and Facebook. Reach out. Would love to chat with you and get to know you and understand your investment criteria as well.
All right. So the final two questions, I've already asked you the first one. So the first one is generally, why multifamily as an investment asset class? Sometimes I do like a second part to the question, and that is,
okay,
what type of life has it afforded you and your family? So if you want to answer that, that'd be great.
I think it's afforded me just one, something I really enjoy, as I said, spending time on. So it's something I enjoy. So it's afforded me to do that. On the financial side, it's just given me much more stability than I think I was ever going to get from the market. As I'm probably older than you, Sean, and look at retirement and building nest egg that I can live off of, is really the stability that it has provided me. It's that cash flow, that passive cash flow that has really afforded me. And then there's the appreciation on the sale that is just
life changed.
Yeah, I can show you the returns, and all I can say is cha-ching.
Yeah, exactly. And that's the point of keep stacking and stacking them.
I tell people one deal becomes maybe 2, 3, 5 years. Reinvested deals, that's 2 deals. Another 3, 4 years, that becomes 4 deals. 4 deals. I mean, it's simple multiplication. I can handle that kind of math.
Right. And 1 year you're selling 5 properties, and it's just like cha-ching, cha-ching, cha-ching.
Now I got a tax problem. How am I going to deal with that?
Exactly. All right. Last question. Since you're a finance guy, and this is also a finance show, every Friday I talk about personal finance because that's my background as well. Question is, the good old, if you had a time machine and you could go back in time, talk to the younger Randy, what would be one piece of financial advice you would give yourself?
Well, I think the 18-year-old Randy, what mature Randy would tell the young Randy would be, is really get involved in real estate earlier. So a lot of good reasons I didn't. I had a young family. My wife was a stay-at-home wife. I didn't. But there are other ways than multifamily. I could have done single families. I could have learned exponentially more. So the single advice I would give to myself is get started earlier and allocate a portion of your portfolio to real estate beyond your primary principal residence. And so for your people listening out there, you say, well, I don't have that. It's tied up in an IRA. Well, you can move some or most of that to a self-directed IRA or a solo 401k to do some of this. It's a very popular strategy for people to do and totally above board. May require a little more work on your part, but the returns are much better.
I love that. I wish I had told myself that too. When I was younger, I did like real estate, but I always thought it was, so this is a limiting belief. I always thought it was something for someone older who had more experience, who had more money. Wish I had educated myself more back then.
Yeah, for me, it was the money. I thought you had to have $1 million idle cash, and you don't.
Nope. That's what's great about syndication. We can all join together and take down a bigger investment, bigger property. But Randy, thank you so much for your time today. This has been a lot of fun, and appreciate you taking time out of the day to come on here.
Sean, it's been a pleasure. As I said, thanks so much, and I hope our paths cross soon.
Yes, I hope so too. Next time I'm in Texas, I will let you know.
Please do.
And listeners, as you know, easy doesn't pay well. Instant gratification is self-destructive. So not only get out there and work hard for your money, but have your money work hard for you so you can create the life of your dream, and we can all make the world a better place. All right. catch you on the next one.
Hey, this is Sean Winslow. After being in the financial service industry for years and having candid conversations with good people just like you, I realized that so many of us are wanting an investment strategy that provides solid returns and consistent income without the bumps in the road. There's little known secret that your financial advisor doesn't want you to know. There is investment out there that is less volatile and the returns are stronger. Get more details by going to greenbriercg.com and clicking on the free e-report. And by the way, if this show has provided you any value, then feel free to leave an honest written review and of course share it with a friend who needs it. See you next week for another great show.